Hand, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. Today we are going to look at a story out of the book of John, which is what we're going through here on Sunday mornings. And this story is actually the beginning of the public ministry of Jesus. It's the account of him performing his first ever miracle. Now, when a band debuts an album, any band that debuts an album takes great care in choosing what single to release to the public first, because they know that when people hear that song, it'll tell them a lot about the band. It'll also tell them a lot about what that particular album's going to be like. Jesus chose to debut his public ministry by making wine at a wedding. He keeps the party going. He was announcing right off the bat, "I am all about joy and life and love. That's my song." So let's read this out of John chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. I'll read it for us. "On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding." I'll talk about that later. "When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, 'They have no more wine,'" which seemed probably pretty obvious at the time, but thanks, Mary. "Woman," and that is not a derogatory comment. In the original language, it's like saying "dear one" or "dear woman." It's not like, "Hey, woman." It's not like that, okay? "So, woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Just do whatever he tells you." She knew, because moms knew, he was going to do it because his mom asked him. He was an obedient child. "Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons of water. Jesus said to the servants, 'Fill the jars with water.' So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, 'Now draw some out and take it to the master or the host of the banquet.' They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, 'Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink.'" So once they're hammered, you can water the whiskey down, okay? That's basically what's going on there. "But you have saved the best for till now." What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and the disciples believed in him. I want to talk about this story in a message I've entitled "Beer Runs, Bathwater, and Beautiful Jesus," because I love some alliteration. But first of all, a little fun fact about this story. John, who wrote this account, was writing to a group of people, many of whom were Greeks. And the Greeks at the time had a god, small g, named Dionysius. And this god was believed, Dionysius, was believed to be the god of wine and festivity. So on one level, this story appears to be about Jesus upstaging Dionysius, because now Jesus is the one making the wine and Jesus is the festive one. That is just an extra for you, a little fun fact to tuck away in your memory. Let's examine this story a little bit closer, starting with Beer Run. Okay, during this time, weddings were a big deal. They're still a big deal nowadays, but they were especially a big deal back then because the wedding wasn't just about two people's happiness. Weddings back then were about the good of the commonwealth because they still lived in a tribal society. So the more families they were, the more kids that were being born, the more numbers in their tribe, the better, because it made the economy better, and it also brought about more safety for that tribe. So when two people got married back then, the whole village came. I always think of Bilbo Baggins' wedding in Lord of the Rings, or his birthday party, rather, in Lord of the Rings. That's what was going on here. It would have been a raucous celebration that probably lasted for days. Now, here's another little fun fact for you. The party really began, they did a ceremony first, and then the party got raucous and started only after everybody waited for the newly married couple to go into a room and physically consummate their relationship. No pressure there, right? Can you even imagine? Hey, hurry up in there, food's getting cold. I mean, I can't even imagine the pressure that was involved with that, okay? But that's what was happening. In the wedding we read about today, the host family ran out of wine. We don't live in this time and culture. We can't imagine what a horror story that would have been. It would have brought such fear and trembling. It would have brought shame to them. It would have brought an abrupt end to the party. There are so many things that cause people to feel shame, but in this particular situation, it was because they didn't have enough. In fact, the Hebrew word for ashamed is boosh. That is a cool Hebrew word, isn't it? And it means dried up. You have nothing good to offer. In our day and age, shame is an epidemic. Carl Jung calls it a soul-eating emotion, and that is so true. And so often, I believe we experience shame for the same reason this host family was going to experience shame, is because we feel boosh, we feel all dried up, like we have nothing good to offer, like we don't have enough. Well, I don't have enough self-control, I keep screwing up. Well, I don't have enough patience. Well, I don't have enough common sense, I make bad decisions. Well, I don't have enough parenting skills. My kids are going to grow up to be tire fires, that kind of thing. Or I don't have enough faith. That happens all the time in the church community. Oh, I don't have enough faith. I'm not like this super spiritual person. A little comment here, by the way. On any given day, I mean, any given day, probably even today, one or two or three or 10 of us are feeling like atheists. We just can't feel, we don't feel any sense of faith at all. That's okay. Just own it and realize that's what community is for. So on the day that you can't find any faith, just borrow the faith of the people around you till you can locate your own, okay? Don't feel shame on that area. But back to shame. The boosh does really eat away at our souls, but here's the good news. Look at the response of Jesus in this situation. His mom persistently asked him to make more wine, and he does it. It was the modern day equivalent of his mom asking Jesus, can you make a beer run to the 7-Eleven because the kegger at the tailgater is dried up. It's remarkable. And Jesus does it and he goes all out. He doesn't just make wine, he makes really good wine. He doesn't make a little wine, he makes a lot of wine, 120 to 150 gallons, somewhere in that neighborhood. That's a lot of bottles of wine. I haven't done the measurement, but that's like a lot of wine, okay? So think about this. This is huge. Jesus removes the host family's shame. The shame of I don't have enough became for them the joy of I actually have more than enough. Their lives were changed. Maybe some of us feel like boosh today. We're carrying some sort of shame. Like we feel like, I just don't have enough. I don't have anything to offer the world. Jesus can and will fill your life to overflowing. He'll deposit so much life and giftedness and love in your life, you'll have plenty to give away. He'll literally do a beer run for your soul on a soul level. And an important part of this story is often overlooked. These hosts went on to share the wine with others. They didn't look at this 150 gallons of really good wine, and they could have just said, hey, party's over, everybody, time to go home, and hoarded it all for themselves. They didn't do that. They shared it with everybody. That's what we're supposed to do. When God fills our life with the abundance of gifts he deposits in our life, we're not supposed to hoard them, we're supposed to give them away. Eric Fromm, great author, he says this, in the act of giving lies the expression of my aliveness. Let me say that again. In the act of giving lies the expression of my aliveness. This is so true. When we give away what God has so richly deposited in our lives, not only is our shame removed, but we actually become more fully alive. Because instead of worrying about what we don't have, we start to give away what we do have, and there's no shame in that. There's actually life in that. Now let's move on to bathwater. Jesus made wine out of the water that had been in the ceremonial wash basin. So hundreds of people would have came to this celebration and washed and rinsed themselves, the dust off their face and hands, and there was no running water. They would have done it all in the same basins. So Jesus was basically making wine out of bathwater. I don't know if you have friends that are really wine connoisseurs, and they taste a wine, and they can say, oh, do you taste the oakiness in it? Do you taste the raspberries that were growing on the hill beside this vineyard? There's literally people like this. I can tell this was on a sunny slope that the grapes were grown on, all that kind of stuff. I always wonder in my mind, this is just my mind, another little fun fact, I just wonder if people tasted the wine Jesus made and went, There's an earthy quality to this. Like, don't you wonder if Jesus was looking and going, I wonder if they're going to taste what this was really made from, the base stock here. I don't know. But the reality is Jesus took something quite ordinary, water, and made it extraordinary, wine. That's amazing. I'm going to show you some pictures. I've been doing this a lot. I'm really into, I don't know what happened to me during COVID. I'm far more into poetry and art than I ever was before, which I think is a good thing. And there's a photographer, and his name is Clark Little. And he takes pictures of ordinary things, waves. You've seen hundreds of them if you've ever been to the coast. But he takes pictures of them, and he turns the ordinary, a wave, into something extraordinary. It probably won't do his photographs justice when you see him here, so Google his name, Clark Little. But here's a couple of them. Look at that. This is not, this is, I mean, it makes, I look at that and just go, that's a wave? That's amazing. It's so amazing. Let's look at another one. Just soak that in. Just, doesn't it make you want to go to the beach right now, though, too? It does do that. And here's the last one. Oh my gosh, it looks like an explosion of sand, okay? Go to the coast and don't just kind of look over the waves, really look at them and let God do that for you too. It's amazing. But God does the same thing that Clark Little does all the time, and not just with water. Think about it. God takes the Bible, which is an ordinary book written by humans, not dictated by God, written by humans under the inspiration of God, but it's ink on paper. That's what it is. But God changes it into something that enables you to hear the very voice of God and give you a vision for life and humanity. It's amazing. God takes an ordinary conversation. Maybe you've had this happen recently. You'll be just chatting with someone, and somehow, in the middle of that conversation, God changes it, and it's no longer just a chat. You realize with every word you speak and every word you listen to that you're connecting with that person on a soul level. How does God do that? It's amazing. Or think about, for me, I hear God a lot through movies, almost as much as I hear God's voice through Bible. Seriously, movies. And I'll be watching a movie, and somehow it's turned into something more than a movie. It's special, not because of the acting or the plot, but because God uses it to stir something inside of me. And I realize somehow the story of this movie is now going to become my story somehow. It's crazy. The last example, communion. We take communion here once a month, and it's just an ordinary cup of juice or wine, an ordinary piece of bread. And God changes it somehow and turns it into a feast for our souls. It's no longer just bread. It's no longer just juice or wine. It's literally we're ingesting grace. It's amazing. It's a miracle every month that we take it. Not every moment of our life is extraordinary, though. Today, I have to go to the pharmacy. Is it open today? It's open. Crap. Okay, so every time I go to the pharmacy, it's like the new DMV for me. You just have to, my wife takes a book on her phone because you have to wait in line so long. Those aren't really extraordinary moments for me, okay? There are a lot of moments like that. But with Jesus, the ordinary becomes extraordinary far more than we realize. We just have to be aware of that. I'm going to put up a quote that I'm going to have you memorize. I probably use it 10 times, and you're going to see it 100 times more. Rumi's in the house, ladies and gentlemen, the mystic poet Rumi. He says this, each moment contains 100 messages from God. If we're aware, the ordinary can become extraordinary, okay? Ordinary moments, ordinary things can be epiphanies for the presence and goodness and truth of God. It's like God looks at our life and says, oh, you thought you were going to skim along on the surface of things. That's cute. No, I've got something better for you. Take a sip of this. Enter into the extraordinary. That's what God does for us. It's amazing. Let's end with this beautiful Jesus. In the verses we just read today, I want you to notice something. Jesus got invited to all different kinds of places and events by all different kinds of people. In this situation, he was invited to a wedding by some Galileans. He got invited to a funeral by a friend's family. He got invited to a party by tax collectors and criminals. He got invited to a dinner by a religious leader, a part of the religious regime at the time. He got invited by some Samaritans, which were believed by most Jews to be religious half-breeds and even enemies. He got invited to stay in their village for a while. Samaritans never invited Jews to stay in their village for a while. Jesus was the kind of person others just wanted, for the most part, to be around and wanted him around them. I told you a couple weeks ago, and I'll rehearse my shame in front of you. I'll just come clean again. Sometimes I'm a little bit of an introvert. I know that's hard to believe, but I actually am. And when I go to the grocery store, that's when I really sink into my introversion. I really don't want to talk to people when I'm in the grocery store. I'm on a mission. Shopping is a mission for me. I have a list, I get it, I pay for it, I leave, the faster the better. And there are times when I see people that I know. None of you, I don't think, but I'm not looking that closely, but I'll be in the grocery store and I'm on my mission, okay? I'm halfway through my list and I'll see a person I know, a neighbor or something, I go, crap, and I'll ditch them. I'll go down an aisle so I don't have to make eye contact and have a conversation because I don't have it in me at that moment. And I don't care what the aisle is, the baby aisle, the wine aisle, the beer aisle, I don't care. I just don't want, and if they happen to follow me, I'll just put on a happy face or whatever. But I do that, and I'm not proud of it. I'm trying not to do it as much. So if you see me in a grocery store, you're gonna have to probably run after me, okay? Just saying that already. People, I don't think, did that to Jesus. They actually sought out his company often. The disciples are a great example of this. These young men dropped what they were doing, their livelihoods, their family. They left their home to follow him day and night, spend 3 years of their life with him. They wanted to be around him. They wanted Jesus around. Put a little comma here, and I'm going to tell you a story I've told some of you before, and then I'll wrap it all together. When I was a youth pastor, I spoke at a lot of camps all over the West Coast, and one camp was almost at the Canadian border. I flew into Spokane, and they drove me up to this camp, and it was in the boondocks, man. It was out there, and it was a great camp, and I made lots of friends. And then this, like, college-age guy drove me back to the airport in Spokane, and when I was driving, I thought, oh, this is great, you know? I get to spend some time alone with this guy, it's great. Well, we're driving and we're literally in the middle of nowhere and there's trees everywhere, and I see a hitchhiker. I don't generally pick up hitchhikers because I've seen too many horror movies in my life, but I thought, man, this is in the boondocks, and it was a really hot day. It was really hot, and I was thinking, I hadn't said anything to the driver, I was thinking, I'm gonna tell him to pull over. But as we got closer to the guy, I realized he was hitchhiking with his thumb out on the road, and on the other hand, he was holding a chainsaw, a chainsaw. And I didn't say anything to the driver. I thought, I'm not saying anything to the driver, and the driver didn't say anything to me, and we just left him. We just passed him right by, because I don't know about you, but the first law I have of picking up hitchhikers is no chainsaws, okay? Like, that's a pretty common law, because chainsaws, that chainsaw made me instantly think, this is a guy I might not want to spend time with at this moment, okay? Jesus is someone you always wanted to be around, and I'm going to tie this in with the chainsaw story. Wait for it, okay? I remember at times in my life, circumstances unfolded in my life in such a way that it made me call into question if Jesus was really good. Because I was going, if Jesus is really good, why are the circumstances of my life unfolding like this? And at times you'll have this experience too. At times in your life, other people will tell you their thoughts about Jesus. Maybe this has happened to you. And you'll be listening to their thoughts about Jesus. And all of a sudden, those thoughts, their ideas about Jesus restrict and oppress and sadden your soul. And you're tempted in both cases like this to think, well, Jesus doesn't sound so good. And maybe you're even tempted to think, is Jesus really good? Is Jesus really good? Or is he just like a hitchhiker with a chainsaw and maybe someone I don't want to be around? Well, I want to share with you three quotes because you know how I love quotes. Two of them you've heard, I'm not heard, and one of them you have heard, but I'm going to repeat it today. And these quotes will remind you of the goodness and the beauty of Jesus, I promise. The first one's by a Catholic priest that I just read his book, and I ordered another one. It's on my Christmas list, Gregory Boyle, and he says this. We'll put it up on the screen. Jesus just stood with the outcast until they were welcomed or till he was crucified, whichever comes first. Isn't that great? The compassion of Jesus is beautiful. Second quote is by Anne Lamott. She writes this, I don't want to follow Jesus. I just want expensive cheeses or something. But anyway, he just wore me out. He won. I love that quote because it talks about how Jesus pursues us, and the faithfulness of Jesus is beautiful. It's beautiful. And the last one I brought up about a month ago, but some of you weren't here to hear it, and I want you to hear it because it's too good to only use once, by a comedian named John Fugelsang. And he says this, Jesus was a radical, nonviolent revolutionary who hung around with lepers, hookers, and crooks, wasn't American and never spoke English, was anti-wealth, anti-death penalty, and anti-public prayer, but was never anti-gay, never called the poor lazy, never justified torture, never fought for tax cuts for the wealthiest Nazarene, and never asked a leper for a copay. He was a long-haired, brown-skinned, homeless, community-organizing, anti-slut-shaming Middle Eastern Jew. Oh, I just love that. Memorize that one. That's a tattoo. It's a long tattoo. You probably have to get it like right through there or something. But I read that quote and I think the very life of Jesus, how he lived when he walked this earth, is beautiful. Jesus is good. Jesus is beautiful. Jesus got invited to places by people. He really did. And the longer I've known him, the better Jesus seems to get, the more compelling, the more interesting, the more loving, the more beautiful. Really does. You know, religion, it's amazing I'm a pastor because organized religion does nothing for me. Nothing. But Jesus does. Jesus just moves me to the core of my being. One more quote from Anne Lamott because she says it best. She says, and she wrote this because a group of Christians in the United States did something that truly was awful in the name of God. And this was her response. She says, it is just mortifying to be a Christian, except for the Jesus part. Oh, that was so good. That was such a good response to what these people had done that was so awful in my mind and obviously hers. So, Jesus does this miracle. It's his opening song. And it's a miracle that removed shame. It's a miracle that showed us that ordinary things and moments can become epiphanies for the presence of God. And it was a miracle that displayed the beauty of Jesus. That's a pretty good debut album for our Savior. I think we can admit that. Jordan's going to come on up now. Come on up, Jordan, my friend. And he's going to lead us in a spiritual practice about this message, and then I'll come up, and I've got a few announcements to close our time on Thanksgiving weekend together. So, Jordan, take it away. Do you got the mic on? Good.
Do I? No.
No.